Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for joining us for February's Orthopaedics Club webinar. I'm very pleased to introduce you to our speaker for today, European and RZVS specialist in small animal surgery, Alan Danielski. Thank you, Alan. I'm now going to hand over to you.
Hi, good morning to everyone. Today we're going to be talking about the orthopedic examination of the thoracic limb. And my hope is that at the end of this hour, you will be able, and especially you're going to feel confident in performing a basic orthopedic examination of a thoracic limb. And usually, to find where the pain is, to perform a good orthopedic examination is the first part of this game, where you need to find all the clues that they're going to tell you where the pain is coming from. And usually this is the first step towards the correct treatment of any dog coming to you with a complaint of thoracic limb lameness. So the first part would be to collect a good decent history from the owner. So it's important to know if the lameness is constantly there, or for example if the lameness is coming and going. It's important to know when the lameness has firstly started. Try to get as many information as you can from the owner, because sometimes they can give you some very important clues and they can literally direct you towards the correct diagnosis. Usually on average, all these clients that come to see me, they always talk about lameness, a limp that is it gets worse after the dog has been lying down for a while, for example, after the dog has been sleeping for a few hours in his bed. And then usually most of the time these lameness, they tend to get better after walking for a few minutes. Usually this kind of history usually suggests you that there is a problem with a joint, for example, because usually once the dog gets up and is, let's say, between bracket cold, the joint is cold, usually that's when it's stiffer. And then once the dog starts walking and it warms up the joint, usually the lameness improves and gets better. Instead, sometimes owners are going to tell you that the lameness is constantly there. He actually is there since he gets up, and he carries on. It actually gets worse towards the end of a walk. And then usually what I always ask is if NSAIDs, so anti-inflammatories, help or they do not help improving the degree of lameness. Because usually, again, if they don't respond to NSAIDs, usually it means that there is something relatively bad going on, or relatively chronic. Instead, usually, if they respond well to NSAID, usually it means that the problem is acute, for example, a swollen joint. And usually, the NSAIDs, they do help getting rid of the swelling for a bit. And usually, the owner at that point, they report a good improvement of the lameness. So then, the next step, after you've taken all the history from the owner, the next step would be to let's have a look at this dog, and let's try to see if the dog is actually limping on the front leg. So, for example, if we have a look, for example, at this video on the left, it's relatively easy to see if the head of this dog starts going up and down, because he's a dog with a short hair. Is quite slim, so it makes it quite easy for you to see if a head goes up and down. But then instead, if we for example, if we had a look at the next video, for example, On the next video, instead, you can see that it becomes much more complicated to have a look, to try to understand when is the head going up and down, because this one is a very fluffy newfie, and that is pulling a lot when he's on the lead. So it doesn't make your life easy at all. So remember that sometimes I still get owners, they do tend to get this thing wrong. Sometimes vets as well, they get this thing wrong. Remember, when the dog puts the weight on the painful leg, that's when the head goes up. Okay, it's like, oh, I'm feeling pain, I don't want to put weight, let me unload the leg, and so my head goes up in order to unload the painful leg. Instead, when I put weight on my normal leg, then at the point my head will go down again. So this head bobbing is very, very, very useful, and it tells you exactly which one is the painful leg. So remember, head up means that the dog is putting weight on the painful leg, heads down, that's the normal leg. So usually, the best way, when you have a dog like, for example, the newfie that I just show you, that is very fluffy and pulling a lot, the best way is to take a slow motion video. And nowadays, every phone has this special function where you can assess the video. You can assess a dog walking on slow motion, and it's extremely useful. This tool, because it really allows you to see exactly on which leg is the dog putting weight when the head goes up and when the head goes down. So for this white dog, it was relatively straightforward. Now, if we move to the next video, for example, like on this case, it will make our life much more easier. If we see this dog walking on a slow motion, again, like remember, heads up, painful leg, heads down, normal leg. Of course, if you had like a dog that is painful on both legs, usually this technique doesn't always work. It might just only tell you which one is the more painful leg, but it doesn't necessarily tells you that the other leg is absolutely fine and has no problems whatsoever. Okay, so now at this point, after we had a look, after we decided on which leg this dog is limping on, we're gonna start putting our hands on the dog. And in the next video, you will see like how I start performing my examination. I made a few different videos, one where we examine the digits and pads. Where one video where we examine the carpus, one video where we examine the elbow joint, and another one where we examine the shoulder joint. And then I'm gonna talk you through the most common pathology that you can see by examining these animals. So now let's start, for example, with this video. So as you can see, usually what you do is that you turn the paw upside down and you start checking the pads. You check for foreign body, you check for cones, you check for anything. I don't know, like for example, like erythema between the pads, and then you start checking every single metacarpophalangeal joints. So simply, usually what I do is that I palpate every single joint to see if any of this joint is swollen or thicker or painful, and then I try to check if they are okay when they move. So if I got like a decent range of motion. I'm mainly talking about the metacarpophalangeal joints and the phalangea and the one between P1 and P2. Those are usually the joints that you can assess quite nicely by doing these by performing these this examination. So again, but it's really important that you always check what's going on also on the pads, because sometimes the problem is there, it's in front of you, but then you just forget to examine the pads, and then you just look silly when the owner goes to somewhere else, and someone else find out that maybe that there is a corn or a small foreign body inside the pad. So, corns. So, for example, like corns are they are warlike lesions. They are also called keratomas. Usually, these lesions they appear as a circular, firm, and raised hyperkeratotic lesions, and usually they are always in the center of a pad. Usually these lesions they tend to affect mainly greyhounds, and in the literature there are a few studies about corns in greyhound, and these studies usually they found out that usually male greyhounds are affected by this problem. In 90% of the cases, it's the thoracic digital pads that are affected, and mostly digit number 3 and number 4. So usually, when the owner comes to you and he start telling you about the problem, the thing that is gonna tell you, "Oh, look for a corn," is my dog is doing absolutely great. It's normal when he's walking on grass on a soft ground, but then as soon as starts walking on gravel. On stones, then at a point it goes very lame. So usually that's already like an indication that you need to check for you first need to check the pads, because it's most likely that the poor problem is coming from there. And usually that's how these lesions look like. So it's like something that is raised, is usually it's got a circular shape, and is sitting in the middle of a pad. On the picture on the right, you can see how it looks after excision. So usually to fix this problem, usually I do use one of these skin biopsy punch, and literally you try to go as deep as you can, and then when you are as deep as you can, then at a point you just cut it with some scissors, and you try to remove all the corn in one go. And usually, so it's pretty much a full thickness incision through the pad, and then after performing a one layer closure, usually it is important to place a protective bandage for at least 2 3 days, because pads they do have a tendency to get infected, and because the dog is putting weight on that region, usually the wound tends to break down. So it's really important to try to keep it soft padded in order to avoid a wound breakdown in the weeks after surgery. Then that's very obvious. Like sometimes you can see it's not so common, but then when you see dogs with this kind of problems, it's pretty obvious to find where the pain is coming from and where the problem is coming from. Again, there is, I think, just only one study in the literature where they started analyzing osteoarthritis in the metacarpal of the digits of dogs, and they found out that usually metacarpal 4 and 5 are usually affected more often than metacarpal 2 and 3. And usually these metacarpal bones have a very unique feature appearance on radiographs, as usually you can see like a lot of periosteal reaction. It is extensive, but it is smooth. So, and there are you're not going to see lysis. Of course, if you are in doubt, if you see that there is some lysis and you're not sure that this lesion looks benign, of course, like it's important in that case to do a bone biopsy and in order to check if it's a tumor or if it's not. These joints is one of the few joints where you can have arthritis without an obvious cause. Several times I get referred cases from GPs that they say, oh yes, this dog had arthritis for several years, but we just treated with anti-inflammatories and we didn't do any more investigations, or we didn't try to understand why the problem was there. And that, I think, is a pity, because for joints like elbows, shoulder, hips, stifle, and hock, usually there is always a reason for that arthritis. And usually, if there is a reason for arthritis, there is most likely that you're going to have a way to treat that problem. So remember, arthritis is just a consequence of a problem. So, for example, arthritis of elbow most likely is a consequence of elbow dysplasia. Arthritis of the stifle joint most likely consequence of cruciate ligament rupture. Arthritis of a hock most likely consequence of an old OCD lesion. And so all these problems, they always have a solution. So you can actually do something to help that dog. So I prefer to be proactive rather than just only blame arthritis and that's it. I'm just going to give anti-inflammatories for the rest of your life. You can always do something to help a little bit more those dogs. So now let's carry on and let's move up a little bit, and we're gonna examine the carpus. Okay, so here's the video. So usually what I start doing, I start palpating the joint. Usually I like to feel with my thumbs, I like to feel if there is any sort of swelling. I like to feel if I can palpate pretty much every single bone in the carpal region. So you can see with my thumbs, I kind of literally feeling for swelling or for thickness or for discomfort. Then at the point when I checked that there is no swelling, or if there is a swelling, then the next thing I start checking for instability of a carpal joint, or I start checking for reduction, for example, in range of motion. So in this case, for example, I can see I'm able to fully flex completely the carpus. I'm able to fully flex the carpus. The dog is not bothered. So it seems like it is that one is a normal carpus. Then I start checking for medial and lateral instability and for dorsopalmar instability as well. Remember, especially on the dorsopalmar plane, that there is always a little bit of movement. So if you feel, if you do this test and you feel that there is movement, don't be scared. It's because you do have some movement. So that's absolutely normal. And talking about the range of motion, usually dogs that have a restricted range of motion, usually they're not able to fully flex the joint as I'm doing now. Usually the range of motion is restricted to 90 degrees. And so if you start to flex it and then you see that the range of motion stops at 90 degrees, and then if you try to push it even more, the dog starts complaining or start being in pain, then usually at the point you can tell, right, this joint is not normal. There is some arthritis. This one might be the reason for the reported lameness. So the carpal joint is a nice joint. It's quite complex, and it acts as a hinge. which is stabilized both by some extra-articular and intra-articular ligaments, and is stabilized at the back by the palmar fibrocartilage, and also stabilized by the joint capsule. The palmar fibrocartilage usually is attached to all carpal bones, with exception of the accessory carpal bone, and usually from there, from there, usually what it does is that it goes down to the proximal palmar aspect of the base of the metacarpal bones, from 3, more or less from here, through 5. Also, another important structure that we have here is the flexor retinaculum, which extends from the medial aspect of the accessory carpal bone to the radial styloid process, and then distally extended down to the radial and the first carpal bones. Other important structures are the medial collateral ligament. Usually in the dogs we have like a straight and an oblique component, and then we have also like the lateral collateral ligament. The main difference, which is quite important, between dogs and cats, is that cats, they do not have the straight component of the medial collateral ligament, and instead, as I just said, the dog has both the straight and oblique part. And this difference is important because cats, they can end up with a palmar antebrachiocarpal luxation simply by having like a partial disruption of the medial collateral ligament of the oblique medial collateral ligament, of the oblique part of the medial collateral ligament. So in cats, it's much easier to end up with a complete luxation of the antebrachiocarpal joint, simply because you have a disruption of that ligament. Instead, in dogs, it's a little bit more difficult, a little bit more complicated, because you need to have a disruption of both the straight and oblique part. Knowing where the disruption is, it's quite important, simply because then that's gonna influence what you're gonna do with that case. It's gonna influence you, and gonna influence what kind of surgery. For example, it's gonna make the complete difference between a pancarpal arthrodesis and a partial tarsal arthrodesis. So usually when I'm feeling the carpus of a dog, and I'm holding with one hand the distal radius, and with the other one I try to hold the first row of carpal bones, and I try to see if there is some instability there. And then if I don't get any obvious instability, then I move my hands, my finger, a little bit lower down, and I try to see if there is any instability a little bit further down, for example, between the carpal bones and the metacarpal bones. On this case, remember, like where the red line is, that's the proximal level of a joint, so it's called antebrachiocarpal level. And then we have, going further distally, we got the intercarpal level, also called the middle level. And then going even more distally, we got the distal level, also called the carpometacarpal level. So anything that affects like the bones, the joint at the level of the red line, they will need a pancarpal arthrodesis to fix a problem. Instead, usually anything that affects the stability a little bit further down, more distally, where the blue line is, usually you can fix it by simply doing a partial carpal arthrodesis. So let's have a look at a few cases. Here we got the video on the left side, where it's pretty pretty obvious where what the problem is, and especially now when the video is going to stop. If you look at the left fore limb, it's pretty impressive, like the way that antebrachiocarpal joint is flexed. So by simply looking at that, I would be able to say, right, it's more like most likely that this dog is going to need pancarpal arthrodesis. So again, sometimes it's very obvious, like in this case. Sometimes you need to start taking X-rays, being able to understand exactly if there is instability and where the instability is. So, like for example, like in this case, if we have a look at this one, it was I think it was a Labrador, 7 years old, and you can see, first of all, like some swelling here. You can see some soft tissue swelling both on the lateral and on the medial aspect. And then on the other view, we have some soft tissue swelling on the dorsal aspect as well. So when you palpate the carpus, you should be able to feel the swelling. Okay, and so then you take an X-ray and you just confirm what you felt earlier on with your own fingers. So it seems like a very something that is not not right down more or less here at this level, but it's difficult to say what exactly it is and what's the solution for that problem. So let's do something else to try to understand. What's wrong? Let's do some stress views. So then, on the first view, we can stress the medial aspect of a joint. On the second view, we can stress the lateral aspect of a joint, and then instead, with the third view, we can stress it on the dorsopalmar direction. And whilst the first two X-rays didn't really tell us much about, so it's not that we can see any opening, any obvious opening of a joint space. These dorsopalmar stress views instead is telling us a little bit more. We can see that whilst the radiocarpal bone seems to be staying in the correct position, and we can see that all the distal row of carpal bones seem to have displaced more caudally. So, in fact, like this dog had an instability at the level of a level between the first and the second row of the carpal bone. So, at the middle level. Pretty much the treatment for this dog was a partial carpal arthrodesis. In this case, I just used like a femoral femoral osteotomy plate that fitted in nicely and allowed me like a good purchase on the carpal bone and on the metacarpal bone number 3. And this one is another case. We got Bella, German Shepherd dog that jumped off the bedroom window. If we look at these X-rays, we got both the right and the left leg. The right one, I don't see any sort of swelling here, so I would say that this one is okay and is relatively normal. Instead, if you look on the left. On the left leg, there is some swelling, some soft tissue swelling. So usually, see swelling, you know that there is something that is not 100% right. It seems relatively okay the rest of the carpus. So again, let's do like some stress views in order to try to understand what's going on. And in this case, we stress the X-rays on a dorsopalmar view level, and then we can see that there is something not right at the distal, at the carpometacarpal level. So you can see that the metacarpal bone, they're not supposed to be, you're not supposed to be able to flex them so much in relation to the distal row of carpal bones. But then again, for completeness, we need to try to understand if there is any instability on the other plan. And so we stressed the X-rays also in a mediolateral direction. As you can see here, the joint space is opening quite a lot. So on this case, because it was a combination of problems, I decided to go for a pancarpal arthrodesis plate because it was safer and the outcome would have been more predictable. If you have a case like this where the radial and ulnar carpal ligaments are only sprained and they're not ruptured, and it's unlikely that you're going to be able to get some palpable instability when you check your dog during the examination. Instead, usually if they are fully ruptured, then usually you have an obvious instability on examination, and then you just need to do some X-rays to confirm some stressed views to confirm where the problem, at which level the problem is. So again, like in this case, like X-rays, they are mainly to confirm your suspicion. So you should be able by your examination, you should be able to feel if there is an instability, and then the X-rays. Instability and swelling, and then X-rays, they are simply there to confirm your suspicions and to decide what's the best thing to do next. Then, of course, as I was saying earlier on, if you have like dogs where the range of motion inflection is very restricted, and usually most of the time is because you can have some bad arthritis, like on these two cases that you can see here. To be honest, you don't see an awful lot of cases like these, but it can happen. Usually, most of the time, they are the results of some sort of arthropathies, like either septic arthropathy or some immune-mediated polyarthropathy. And usually, the best treatment for these kind of cases usually is either a pancarpal arthrodesis or amputation. Again, like these are things that you can palpate them. So in your clinical examination, you should be able to feel that the joint is extremely thick, that the joint does not want to flex, and then when you flex it, the dog is very painful. So again, X-rays, they are just only there to confirm what your suspicious was. So pretty much for digits and carpals, your examination pretty much tells you everything about what's going on. The X-rays, they are there just only to confirm what your suspicions were. Okay, now let's move a little bit further up. When we move up from the carpus, usually I do like to palpate nicely both the radius and the ulna, because, for example, you have dogs where you have panosteitis or where you have a tumor. And then by pressing firmly on the long bones, you get a painful reaction. And then again, that tells you where the problem is most likely to be. So as you can see, like I'm palpating the radius, I'm palpating the ulna, and then I move up and I start examining the elbow. So what I'm doing here is that pretty much with my thumb, I'm checking for effusion to check. I'm checking for swelling, because sometimes if you have like a very swollen joint, usually you can really palpate it is a puffiness, and there where my thumb is there now, so close to the ulnar notch, and usually that's like an indication that there is something not right with that joint. And then at that point you carry on with your examination. And then you start extending the elbow joint and you check for pain, and then you flex the elbow joint and you check for pain, and then you check for you perform also supination and pronation of the limb. That's it, like I'm doing now. That's supination to check for pain or pronation to check for pain. And usually, dogs they do tend to show you if there is pain on flexion extension. Now moving to the next video. Sometimes you need to perform the the examination when they are asleep, because sometimes they are too aggressive. And so in this case, of course, you won't know if that dog is painful when you perform those maneuvers, but then the aim of this examination when they're asleep is simply to check if you got any mechanical restraint, or if you can feel any crepitus, or if you can feel something majorly wrong. Usually the best thing is to do it when the animal is awake, because then in this way it's going to show you pain. And then usually that's the best one at showing you where the pain is coming from. Now, let's have a look, for example, at a couple of dogs that have elbow pain, so you can see exactly what I mean. So, for example, like the first one is Black Labrador. So as you can see, like what I'm going to do now, I'm going to check the extension to see for pain. This dog does not seem particularly painful on extension, but then can you see on flexion, the dog starts moving the entire weight, his entire weight away from me, and you can see that also like his face is not happy. And usually I find out that when you have a painful elbow and when you have a problem, for example, like a elbow dysplasia, the flexion is what gives you the best indication of pain in dogs. So now this one was the right forelimb. Let's check next video with the left left thoracic limb. As you can see, I'm extending the elbow. Dog is not very happy when I'm extending the elbow, and then I start flexing, and you can see that the dog is literally throwing himself away from me because it's like, ouch, I'm painful. I don't want you to flex my elbow. Please stop it. So again, like you can see, like it doesn't is a very natural movement. What you're doing is very natural. So you're just literally flexing the elbow, and so that's why I think that it's very is an excellent thing to check in order to see if that dog actually has pain or doesn't have pain. Next video, we'll see a very similar case where we have this spaniel that usually like it gets and stands up on like it sits on the back legs again because he's trying to move his weight away from me, and because he does not want to flex his elbow because it's too painful. In spaniel, the extension, elbow extension test is quite important, as you know, because spaniels, they tend to have this intracondylar fissure or incomplete ossification of humeral condyle, as you want to call it. And so when you extend the elbow joint, what you do is that you pretty much you push with your anconal process. You push against the humeral condyle. So if you have like a weakness there, you will cause pain. So usually I'm always quite careful at the dog reaction if I'm dealing with a spaniel and if I'm suspecting an incomplete ossification or an intracondylar fissure, and I'm performing I'm extending the elbow. So yes, these are the two examples like of how important your examination is in showing you where the pain is coming from. And then, do you remember when I was talking to you at the beginning of examination of elbow joint, when I was talking to you about when I was telling you about the effusion? You can see it very well in these two pictures. This one was a dog. I think it was a Labrador that came in for a suspected elbow dysplasia, and so like when I took him to theater, I had seen like I was able to palpate the effusion during the clinical examination, but then once the dog got clipped, it was even more obvious. So you can see very well on both on the lateral and on the medial aspect on this case, you can see very well the swelling And again, the swelling is about to tell you that that joint is not happy, and then that you have a problem. Most common elbow problems. Most common is elbow dysplasia, of course, that includes uniting and corneal process, osteochondritis, dissecans, fragmented corneal process, or incongruency. And then, of course, like also the intracondylar fissure or incomplete ossification of the humeral condyle, if you prefer to call it like that. Let's have a very quick look about these diseases. Usually the uniting and corneal process usually affects large giant dogs, mainly Great Danes, Bernese, German Shepherd dogs, or Golden Retriever. And it's a bilateral disease in something between 20 and 35% of the dogs. And male dogs usually they are twice as affected as female. Usually the lameness becomes obvious in the first 5 to 12 months. So most of the dogs that you see coming through the door with acute lameness, usually they are young dogs. And this is because the corneal process develops as a single separate center of ossification. And in theory, it should fuse by 14, 15 weeks of age in greyhounds. Instead, it should close a little bit later, in around 16, 20 weeks in German Shepherds. So if you, for example, you see a dog, a German Shepherd, for example, that is 25 weeks old, and you can still see like this radiolucent line across the corneal process, then you know that that's going to be a diseased corneal process that hasn't fused. The reason for that is unclear. No one really knows why, but most of the people they think that is because there is an asynchronous growth between radius and ulna. So usually the ulna has an early closure of the distal physis. It doesn't grow as much as the radius and humerus, and then at some point the humerus start pushing on these fragile and corneal process. And it causes is detachment. Diagnosis is easily made. Usually on X-rays or CT scan, you can see it very, very well. Remember that if you diagnose this problem in an old dog, so let's say that you have a dog that is 7 years old, 8 years old, and it comes through the door for forelimb lameness, you do some X-rays and you see this detachment corneal process. That's probably not the real cause of a problem because of a lameness, because the corneal process has been detached for the last 7, 10 years. So it's unlikely that it's going to cause an acute episode of lameness. So in that case, I would probably suggest you to have a look at the rest of the joints in order to see if there is another concomitant problem. And usually, dogs with these kind of problems, usually when you do your clinical examination, you do feel the crepitus when you manipulate the elbow joint in flexion extension. So is you can really feel like you have a crunchy feeling the level of elbow joint, and usually they tend to be mostly uncomfortable when you extend the elbow joint. And remember, like just only if you see like a young German Shepherd coming through the door, that's got elbow pain. That must be at the top of your differential diagnosis. Here, just only a few other examples of how you can diagnose this problem on X-rays, and then how you can diagnose it on CT scan. Okay, so now let's move to the next one, osteochondritis, osteochondrosis, osteochondritis. Usually, it indicates like a developmental condition of growing cartilage in skeletally immature animals. And in this case, usually this problem is due to a lack of vascularization. There are different theories, but the most accepted is that like there is not enough of blood supply going to that area of cartilage, so that area of cartilage dies and it becomes detached from the bone. And then, of course, like when you have subchondral bone that is gets in contact with the joint fluid, that bone becomes very upset. And so automatically becomes very sclerotic and hard. Usually, it's always the same kind of breed with this kind of problem. So remember that when you see like a young animal, something like a mastiff, like a Newfie or a Bernese, so large breed dogs, and you have elbow pain. And in these cases, usually if they are young dogs, these elbows, they tend to be very swollen when they come to you. So if you are examining one of these dogs and they are young dogs and you can feel that there is a lot of swelling coming from that joint, you know that OCD has to be on the top of your differential diagnosis. And then usually just enough to do a CT scan or even with X-rays you can see it quite well. And usually you are able to see like a big hole in the usually at the level of a medial condyle, like in this case, and then also you can see usually that the bone, the rest of the humeral condyle, or the medial humeral condyle, usually is very sclerotic and very white. Okay, instead, like if we are talking about fragmented coronal process or incongruency, usually dogs coming to you, usually they are of two different, they belong to two different groups. You either have very young dogs, usually anything between 8 months and 2 years old, or otherwise you have an older group of dogs, that's usually dogs that are older than 3, 5 years. So usually the younger group, usually again, always the same breeds, Labrador, Golden Retriever, Rottweiler. Usually, this dog, we do show intermittent lameness. So the owner will tell you, oh, my dog has been on and off well. Sometimes it gets worse, but then sometimes it gets better. It definitely responds to anti-inflammatories. So anti-inflammatories, they sort the problem out. And then usually on these dogs, if you have a filled elbow joint, usually you do not feel any thickness. You do not feel any restriction of the range of motion. Sometimes you can feel some swelling, some effusion, but usually there is no no or there are no osteoarthritic changes. Instead, like, and usually this one are the dogs that have like usually a fragmented coronoid process, or for example, an OCD lesion. Instead, like the other category of older dogs, usually these dogs that are older, usually they are lame at all times. So usually the owner tells you that yes, anti-inflammatories they do help a little bit, but then the dog carry on limping. And usually when you do your examination, you can feel that the joint is thicker. And usually when you try to flex the elbow joint, most of the time it locks at around 90 degrees, and you're not able literally to flex it anymore than that. And then, of course, you take your X-rays, and then you see that there are some severe changes visible on X-rays. So usually, these dogs they do not tend to have a fragmented coronary process, or they might have it, but then that's not the main problem. The main problem is that usually these dogs they tend to have no cartilage whatsoever left in their elbows. Because usually they also have incongruency and the joint has been inflamed for several years, so usually these dogs they need something a little bit more drastic to in order to get fixed. But usually You have these two categories of groups, these two groups of dogs, and with a completely different physical examination. So, like, you can, by performing like a correct examination of these dogs, you might already be able to tell the owner, look, I think that's what we have, and so it's better if we do something now, or it's better if I refer you now, or it's better if I do a CT scan now. So it's gonna help you an awful lot in deciding what's gonna be the next step. So let's have a look at some x-rays just to help you out a little bit in identifying where the problem might be. So here we got like some x-rays. The one on the left is a relatively extended elbow joint, in the middle flex joint, and then on the right side a craniocaudal view. So usually we look for secondary changes, because unless we have an innate anconial process, we're not going to be able to see what's going on. So we look for changes. We look for something, some clues, for something that is going to tell you, hey, there is something that is not right with this elbow joint. Do some additional investigations. So first of all, we started checking on the... working, let's see. Okay, and so you start checking the cranial aspect. You check for osteophytosis, for arthritis at the cranial aspect of the radial head, where the red line is. So you look for spurs of bone that will suggest that there is a process, inflammation, some arthritis going on. Then the next place where to look is you try to see if you can follow the cranial margin of the anconial process, of the coronoid process on the lateral view. Usually, if you can follow that line, usually it means that everything is okay. If that line becomes very fuzzy and you are not able to follow it up to the joint, it might tell you that there is something that is not right. Next thing to check, dorsal aspect of anconial process, green line. So again, we look for arthritis there, we look for osteophytosis, we look for new bone, for spurs of bone. Again, that you can check it, unfortunately, only on the flexed view, and that's why you take a flexed view and you take an extended view. So that's the next step, the next place where you're going to look for problems. Then the next thing, you go for look for subtrochlear sclerosis. So you try to see how wide the white area is, because if it's very white and then the width of the white area is very large, usually that tells you that the bone has become very hard in response to some kind of problem that is going on with the elbow joint. So again, that's something more that's going to tell you there is something not right with this joint. And then we move to the craniocaudal view. We look for these HIF, intracondylar fissure, or incomplete ossification of humeral or humeral condyle. Usually you need a slightly oblique view, craniocaudal view. Sometimes you can see it very well. You can see a nice radiolucent line right there in the middle. Sometimes you don't, and you need to perform a CT scan. And then lastly, the last thing we are going to check is for signs of OCD. So on the medial condyle, you try to see if you can see any black hole or any, you try to see for any black hole in that area. So, again, like for example, this one are x-rays of a dog with disease. And as you can see on the x-rays on the left, we have a lot of arthritis and remodeling in front on the cranial aspect of the radial head. We have in the x-rays on the middle, we have osteophytosis on the top of the anconial process. That's the yellow line, and then we have an awful lot of subtrochlear sclerosis. That's what is inside the red circle. And then on the x-rays on the right side, again we can see that there is a lot of newborn formation, osteophytosis along the edge of a joint capsule. So, for example, like this one is just only a very quick example of how important it is to look for these tiny kind of signs. So, in this case, for example, if you look at the subthyroid sclerosis, you can see that it's quite wide the white area. On the top of the inguinal process, there are no osteophytes. In front of the radial head, not really osteophytes. The only change is this increased subthyroid sclerosis. So it's a very, very, very subtle sign. Again, like a medial humeral condyle looks okay. And then this one is the CT scan for that dog. Actually had disease in both elbows, and you can see like he had like a complete fragmented coronoid process. So that's just only to tell you how important is to have a look at the X-rays. And this dog also had like some discomfort when I was flexing his elbow. So you see, you might flex his elbow, see that there is some discomfort. When you take the X-rays, you see nothing noticeable. Like in this case, you say, "Oh, don't worry, it's fine. You can go away. I give you some anti-inflammatory and rest for 2 weeks," and then the dog will carry on lame. The owner will carry on coming back to you, and you're not gonna know what to answer to the owner. And it's important to correlate your clinical examination with the radiographic changes, even if subtle. Now, let's move forward, and we get to the shoulder joint. So usually when I check the shoulder joint, usually I check the shoulder joint in extension, I check it in flexion, I try to feel if there is any clunk, I try to feel if there is any instability, or I try to feel if there is any focal pain. So pretty much like now, what I'm just doing now with my thumb is that I'm pressing on the caudal aspect of the humeral head, because usually if you have an OCD lesion, that's where the dog is gonna be painful. And then usually the other place where to press is at the front where the bicipital groove is. So now what I'm doing right now is the biceps test. So I'm trying to see if I'm able to fully extend the elbow having the shoulder flexed. In theory, you're not supposed to be able to do that because the biceps is going to stop you from fully extending the elbow. And usually if you have a dog that have bicipital problems, bicipital pain, usually they go mad when you do this thing. My recommendation would be always to check also the contralateral limb, because sometimes you find some dogs that are pretty much able to fully extend the elbow, and you think, "Oh God, this one has got a positive bicep test, so there must be a problem with biceps." But then you do the same test on the other side, and the result is exactly the same. So that's a dog that is actually normal. So the shoulder joint has both some active and some passive stabilizers, and usually the active stabilizers, they are made by muscles, so like the infraspinatus, supraspinatus, subscapularis, and teres minor muscles, and to a lesser extent also the biceps brachii muscle. And then instead we also have some passive mechanism where those for which muscle activity is not required. Which are like that include a limited joint volume, concavity compression, all the ligaments, ligaments and tendons of the joint, and also by the tendon of origin of the biceps brachii muscle. So, in general practice, in most commonly, the only problem you have with a shoulder joint is either like an OCD lesion if you have a very young dog, or is either a problem with this biceps tendon. So usually checking for the bicep test usually is quite important. And this one is a nice cadaveric image where you can see very well the biceps, where it attaches down at the bottom and where it attaches up at the top. So pretty much that gives you an idea why, first of all, you're not able to fully extend the elbow joint when you do your biceps test, because the muscle can elongate up to a certain point, and then it's just not going to elongate anymore. And then, except If he has like a problem up at the top where the tendon, for example, is partially ruptured. So if that tendon is partially ruptured, you're gonna have pain when you flex, when you stick your finger there on the groove, and then you're gonna be able to fully extend the elbow joint. If you have a biceps test that is negative, but you have still pain, so negative means that you're not able to fully extend the elbow joint, but you have some focal pain when you stick your finger up where the groove is, where the tendon is sliding, then it's probably because you can have some arthritis, some newborn formation, like you can see in the CT image at the bottom on the right side, where you can have some like kind of like a new groove, new osteophytes, newborn formation compressing and impinging the tendon. So in those cases, you're gonna have pain when you put some focal pressure there, but then you're gonna have a bicep test that is negative. Okay. So then let's quickly talk about shoulder instability. Is quite rare, to be honest with you. We don't see many cases like this. We, for example, here at Davis, we might see between myself and my colleague maybe 5 cases every year, something like this. So is quite uncommon. Is a problem usually that can affect usually both the large and small breed dogs. If it's in small dogs, usually it's the result of a congenital soft tissue laxity. From an orthopedic examination point of view, what you want to check is the degree of subluxation, the angle of subluxation of the humerus in relation to the scapular blade. So pretty much what there was this study published on veterinary surgery where the assessor was putting his left hand on the acromion process in order to keep the scapula still, and then with the other hand was lifting up the rest of the leg. And for example, in the picture at the bottom, in figure A, you can see a dog that has some medial instability of the left shoulder. Instead, in figure B, you have like a normal say range of motion of a shoulder, and so the figure B was the normal side of a dog, and this guy that came up with some reference, some range of angles that would allow you to identify when a dog is has got instability or when it doesn't. So usually, if you use the goniometer and you have an angle between scapula, shoulder blade and humerus of something around 32 degrees, usually that's normal. If it's above 53 degrees, is abnormal. Again, my recommendation is always check the other leg, always, because I don't like to rely so much on goniometer because it's very variable. It depends, it can change a lot simply based on where you put it. And then also because you can have some difference. You can have some dogs that they don't fall within this category, and so some dogs that they go more lax shoulders, and those shoulders are absolutely fine. It's just the way the dog is. And then we move to OCD humeral head. So, for example, do you remember when I showed you the video earlier on when I was pressing with my thumb on the caudal aspect of the humeral head? Usually, these dogs are very, very painful when you press there. And sometimes, especially if you are slim dogs with short hair, usually you are sometimes able to feel the joint effusion. But the most important thing is pain. Is pain. So usually dogs that come with this kind of problem, usually they are between 4 and 8 months 4 and 8 months of age, and usually they have a painful joint on focal pressure application. Usually they're not so painful when you flex and extend the elbow joint, unless they have a lot of swelling in that joint. And usually you take some X-rays or you do a CT scan, and it's very obvious what the problem is. There are no many other problems related to the shoulder joint, except sometimes you can have some very bad cases of arthritis. Usually, most of the time they are related to old OCD lesions. The thing that I would like to point out is that a lot of time I do get cases referred for shoulder problems. A lot of time. And then you see the dog here. In reality, the dog has got like an elbow problem. And that's why, because a lot of GP, what they do, when they check the extension of a shoulder joint, that's what they do. So they extend the shoulder joint, the dogs start crying in pain, and so they think, right, this dog has got a shoulder problem. But in reality, the problem is that you are at the same time extending the elbow joint. So if you have a problem related to the elbow joint, that dog will cry and will show pain, and so automatically you will believe that the problem is the shoulder joint, and in reality is the elbow joint. Out of all the cases referred for shoulder problems, I think probably 90% of them, they are not related. The real problem is not within the shoulder, but is within the elbow joint. So always check the elbow, check to your flexion, check your extension, try not to move the other joints. So when you examine the shoulder joint, try not to extend or flex the elbow joint in order not to get mistaken because of that. Next, well, as we said, panosteitis. That's something that you're gonna be able to find out with your orthopedic examination if you put some firm pressure along these long bones. So panosteitis, we all know what it is. Self-limiting inflammatory disease of a bone marrow of the long bones. Usually, dogs that have this problem, usually they are between 5 and 12 month of age. But sometimes it's been reported even in younger dogs, and sorry, in older dogs. Pardon me. And clinical signs, usually they are quite variable, so they can go from shifting lameness to sometimes, rarely, inability to walk. So again, you can have an owner that comes to you and say, "Look, my dog has got lameness that goes from right to left. Sometimes it's better, sometimes it's not. It responds well to anti-inflammatories." On that case, take some X-rays. The X-rays, most of the time, they show you exactly what the problem is, and then at that point, you know that you can give this dog anti-inflammatories for a long period of time, and that's most likely to solve the problem. And then lastly, neoplasia. Again, that's something that you're going to be able to confirm by examining properly the dog. Most of the time, you have a diagnosis even before taking some X-rays. So if you see a dog that is extremely lame, or if he's non-weight bearing, you know that there is something really bad going on at that time. So usually, if you have, for example, you see a dog coming through the door that is limping a lot, let's go for with a video number two now. If you have a dog that is old and when he walks, he's either non-weight bearing, like on this case here, or he's very lame, usually most of the time you can already diagnose it without even putting your hands on the dog. And usually, this dog, they got some nasty tumors, like this one on the left affecting the ulna, or this one on the right affecting the radius, or affecting the proximal humerus. So, for example, if you see this picture on the right side, you can tell that this dog has got something very nasty by simply looking at this picture, because the dog is not putting weight, he's old, as you can see by his white face, and he's got tremendous muscle wastage. So all these three signs, they already tell you, they should like make an alarm start bleeping in your head, saying, "Ooh, there is something really wrong about this dog. And most of the time, especially if you're dealing with an old dog, that's tumor is the most common diagnosis. Again, sometimes also you can see some swelling. For example, if it was the distal radius where there is not much soft tissue covering the bone. If you see this dog, you do examination, you see that there is like a large firm swelling that is very painful on palpation, and the dog is 10 years old and then it's got muscle wastage and not putting weight, you have your diagnosis without even doing some x-rays. Lastly, which is probably the most difficult thing to diagnose in dogs, is how do you diagnose if you have like a soft tissue or muscular lesion? Can you tell if the dog has pulled a muscle, as the clients always say? Well, that's usually a diagnosis by exclusion. So if my examination of a digit, carpus, elbow and shoulder joint are normal, if I take some x-rays and those x-rays are perfectly normal and I don't see anything wrong going on with the long bones at that point, you know that it's most likely that this dog has a soft tissue muscular problem. Of course, like, I'm not talking today about the possible neck problems, because of course if you had like a lateralized disc extrusion, then that potentially could cause you like intermittent lameness. But in the usually in the vast majority of the cases, if your bones and joints are all fine, usually at that point you can make a diagnosis of soft tissue lesion, because I cannot find anything else wrong. So the common belief, especially between general practitioners, is that you can sort out these kind of problems with just only 2 or 3 weeks of rest. That's not the case. So usually those cases, if you have like a real muscular problem, usually you need to restrict that dog exercise for something between 2 and 3 months. Okay, which means that the dog is still allowed to go out for a walk. That's absolutely fine, but he has to be on the lead. So usually what I recommend is you can take your dog out for a 15-20 minutes walk on the lead up to 3 or 4 times a day for 2 months. And then if at that point you still tell me that the dog is sound and is absolutely fine, then at that point you can take him out for a little bit longer, still on the lead for another month. And usually that's the time that it takes for this kind of soft tissue or muscular lesion to resolve. So going for 2 or 3 weeks, it does absolutely nothing, because as soon as the dog starts re-exercising or jumping, then that muscle will get hurt again, and then you're going to start from the beginning. It is really, really important to disclose this with the owner and be very clear about it, because some owners, they think that it's okay to, well, that they still keep the dog on the lead, but then indoors, they let the dog jump around, play with the other dogs, do stairs, jumping off the sofa, these kind of things, and then, of course, that doesn't help. So it just as a result, it just results in a big headache for you, because you're not able to understand what's going on. You think that you got it all covered, but the owner is actually not following your instruction. And so finally, the main take home message that I would like you to take home is that if you see a dog that comes to see you and is non-weight-bearing lame, there are just only 3 reasons for this non-weight-bearing lameness. One is fracture, second one is infection, third one is neoplasia. Okay. So again, if you see a dog coming through the door with a non-weight-bearing lameness, these are the 3 things that you need immediately to think about, and then all the rest of your clinical examination is going to be about try to find where the fracture is, or where the infection is, or where the neoplasia is, and then will make your life so much easier, I promise you. So just remember this thing next time you have like a dog that is non-weight-bearing lame coming through the door. And that's it. So I hope that explain it well. I hope that I'm gonna make your life a little bit easier at the time of examining a dog. When I started doing orthopedics, I was scared by the orthopedic examination. I didn't really know what to do, but it's really important to be systematic. So you start from the bottom and you go up. Remember, it's like a game. You need to find where the pain is coming from. Once you got exactly where the pain is coming from, that's it. Then at the point you can decide, you can start doing other investigation, or you can decide to refer the case if you're not keen to do any further investigation. But you see, that's already a success if you can manage to know where the pain is coming from. It's like a game. Okay, so yes, if you have any questions, I'm happy to answer to any questions.
On behalf of Webinar Club, I'd like to thank Alan for a great presentation today. The recording and the certificate for this webinar will be available in the next few days in the members area of Webinar Club. Thank you all for attending. That's the end of the webinar.